Good morning, everybody. Thank you. How are we all doing on this beautiful winter's day? It is freezing outside, though I'm told Chicago is far worse. Yeah, I knew that was coming. I tried to stave that off at the pass. Yes, Chicago's worse, but London's better. So what can you do? And it's election day in London. I sent in my postal vote. We'll see what difference that makes. Yeah. You have 15 years since you've resided in the country to vote. I don't remember when I last resided in the country or what counts, but I filled it online. They sent it to me. So I think I'll be the decisive vote in this election. So we'll see what happens. And the advantage is you don't have to stay up till midnight to find out because they're 5 hours ahead. 10 o'clock? Why 10 o'clock? Oh, this time? Their time. Oh, so we'll know by 5 p.m. All right. We'll find out. Okay. So I've changed the font at the top of the page a little bit. I don't expect anybody to notice nor care, but I enjoyed it, and I changed the font a little bit. Having said that, what's this week's parasha? Anybody know? There you go. It says it there, yes. As I said last time, somebody asked me to put it on the sheet. It's on the sheet. So I want to do a little overview of this parasha before we return to our pasuk to put some pressure on a particular moment. And of course, what is the centerpiece of this week's parasha, Vayishlach? What is the most dramatic scene? The struggle, the wrestling of Jacob with the angel. Does he wrestle with an angel? Maybe. But what does the pasuk say? He wrestled with an ish, a man. And it's very unclear, which is obviously an intentional ambiguity to allow us to read this scene in different ways. Was he wrestling with a human being who is unnamed, or was he wrestling with an angel, an ish? Was he wrestling with himself? Was this a nighttime internal turmoil that he was wrestling with who he was going to be? It's been read in all those ways, but let's start from the very beginning. Vayishlach, somebody sends something. Who sends something? Yaakov sends messengers in Hebrew, Malachim. It's unclear whether they are celestial messengers, whether he has the capacity to send out angels, or whether he's sending human beings. And that's Rashi just says Malachim Mamash, real Malachim, presumably angels. But again, that's viewed differently. And he has a message for his brother. He's trying to figure out what's going on. They come back and they tell Yaakov, we went to your brother, to Esav. He is coming with 400 men, to which Yaakov responds, wonderful, we'll have a bar mitzvah. No, what does Yaakov say? 400 men are coming. This is not good. He's terrified. He thinks they're coming armed with weapons to fight, and he is terrified. So he prepares in three ways. What are the three things that he does? He prays, he splits the camp, and gives gifts. The three P's or the three G's? Prayer, present, plan, gift, God, strategy. There's a G at the end of that. Okay, so those are the three possibilities of what he attends to. Correct. He then gets to the river Yavok. He crosses over the river with his family. He says, I've forgotten something. I'm going to go back and get them. He goes back onto the other side. And it's at that moment when he's on that side of the river by himself that he is accosted by this ish, by this figure, and they fight until dawn. And it is that, as we've said, wrestling, which features as part of this double centerpiece, that he wrestles with a figure on the side of the river, and he's going to meet his brother. They tend to mingle in our imagination because the sages see that figure as a representative of Esav. So it's really, that's the fight, and then they meet later. But they're two episodes that come together. And it's interesting how different scenes in the biblical text speak to different people in different ways. I once had a conversation with Rabbi Sachs. Being from England, there were only three of us, so I got together, said hello. And I was a young kid, I guess, relatively speaking. One of the questions I had for him, he was still chief rabbi at the time. I said, have you ever had a moment where you just want to run for the hills? Anyone know what that means? Yeah, he didn't. he said, I'm not familiar with that phrase. I'm like, I mean, it's itself explanatory. I said, you know, have you ever had such a moment of such pressure and tension, and you've been kind of beaten up from the right and the left and the center, and you just said, you know what, I just want to get out of here. Just want to have a little bit of anonymity, a little bit of peace, a little bit of rest. He said, oh, now I know what you mean. And his answer was essentially just feeding off this scene, the wrestling at night. And he said, what is it that Yaakov does to finish the fight? Meaning Yaakov is essentially triumphant. He gets injured on his thigh, but he's holding the ish down in a headlock. And he could have hurt him. He could have thrown him down. How does the wrestle end? How does the fight conclude?
He wakes up.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Rambam. He wakes up. Interesting. There is a view in Maimonides that this was entirely a dream, that angels aren't embodied, that there was no fight on the side of a river. This was a dream. Of course, the problem with that being he's limping at the end of it. Of course, you have the psychiatrist jumping in and calling it psychosomatic. There we go. Having said that, how does the dream end then? How does this fight terminate? He gets a bracha. Yaakov says, I will not let you go until you bless me. And Rabbi Sack said that that's kind of the archetype of human experience, that we all wrestle with things. We all get into skirmishes. But the way we should conclude is by saying, I'm not going to let this go. I'm not going to leave this trauma until I can find a way to get a blessing out of it. I'm not going to walk away until I can make this productive. And it's actually a dramatic emblem of hope in that sense, that every time we fight, we don't just survive, we don't just walk away, we don't just move on, but I refuse to walk away from a moment of struggle until I can find some blessing out of it, which is a way to view providence as well, that everything in life comes our way, we can wrest meaning from it. It doesn't have to be purposeless. So that's one of the central scenes. Then after that, they get up in the morning. He either wakes up or he's a little tired after a night fighting, and he's coming towards his brother. And if you were doing a film and you were presenting this moment, the music would be building, the tension would be high. Yaakov would be there. You'd hear the pounding beat of the music. Esav is coming, and then what happens? Esav runs over, gives him an embrace, gives him a kiss, and cries on his shoulder. Tension lows. Everyone's calm. And Esav says, who are these people? I haven't seen you in 2 decades. They introduce each other, and Yaakov is incredibly self-effacing. He bows 7 times. He refers to his brother as Adoni, my master. He calls himself Avdecha, your servant. He is incredibly submissive in that scene, for which some critique him, but others praise him. Rabbi Sacks, talking of Rabbi Sacks, anyone know what his latest book was called? It was a couple years ago, so it wasn't that recent. In fact, I think he spoke here as part of the book tour, and I understand there are a couple of boxes of it in the office if anyone want to purchase any more still. Not in God's Name. He's written a number of works, and often they overlap. But this was his latest one. He's now working on a chumash, I'm told. But his latest book, or most recent book, Not in God's Name, was about contesting religious violence and saying that somebody had to speak in the name of religion, that this religious violence is unacceptable, while also accepting culpability for some of the violence that religion has projected onto the world. And he describes a number of scenes from Bereshit, from Genesis, where there's sibling rivalry and dysfunctional family life and violence. And he tries to address these different scenes. And he has a reading of this scene where Yaakov and Esav meet. And he says essentially that we're expecting Esav to be this horrific figure holding a grudge for 22 years. And at the moment he runs over to give Yaakov a hug, we understand who he is, which is a figure who lives in the moment, whose mood is swayed by the day. He says, oh, Yaakov's here, great. He completely forgot and let go. He didn't really care about the birthright in a deep sense. It just struck him at the time. That's the way Rabbi Sacks read it, but there are other ways to read it. Either way, they are about to part ways. Esav says, come with me, let's live together. Yaakov says, oh, I'm good. And he says, okay, let me leave you some men. I'm good. We'll be okay. And he's doing his best to kind of keep going in different ways. And one of the statements that he's told them initially was, im lavan garti, which means what? I lived with Lavan. Now, how would you say I dwelt with somebody or I lived with somebody? Shachanti, yashavti. There are different ways to speak about settling. Ger is, by definition, an alien state. Ger v'toshav anachi is what Avram said a couple of weeks ago. I'm an alien and a resident. Lagur is to kind of very transiently live in a place. He says, im lavan garti, which is a very strange thing. He lived there for 2 decades. Why is he speaking about it as a transient experience?
It was never his home.
He never felt at home. Why did he never feel at home? Go on. What do you mean?
I missed your last 2 classes, so.
That's okay. Me too.
Where he says, and when he tells his wives, we're leaving because your father's face is not the way it was. He's not reacting to me and to us the way he used to in the past. So he's never felt, he was never really a family member.
Oh, interesting.
He worked for him.
So you're saying he never was made to feel at home. When he says, im lavan garti, this is not a point of pride. What is he confessing? I was an outsider. I was never let in. And essentially, don't think for a moment that the blessings that I was given have come to fruition. Im lavan garti, no one let me in. I've been living in a state of alienation, a state of rejection for more than 2 decades. Okay, interesting. Why else might he say, yeah?
He removed himself from Lavan.
Right, this is kind of the other pole, which is not that im Lavan garti, he never let me in, but I never wanted to get in. Maybe Lavan tried to bring him in, and there's a moment last week when he first gets to Lavan's house, and Lavan says, interesting story, because Yaakov tells him, I deceived my father, I got my brother's blessing, now he wants to kill me, I'm in a bit of trouble, please let me into your house. And Lavan says, ach, Atzmi uvasari ata. Exactly. Thank you. You are my bone and you are my flesh. And he lived with him for a month and then stayed longer. But Lavan says, fine, come on in, your family. And last Friday night, I spoke about what was the meaning of that. Why did he say, oh, your family, come in? And it looks on the surface like he's making a concession. Really, I don't want you to come in, but your family, I'll let you in. And last Friday night, anyone at shul last Friday night? Good. I'm going to test you now. So what were the two of you? Why did Lavan not want Yaakov to come in? Why do you have no reason for him to come in? Guesses, I'm happy. You don't have to have been there last Friday night. He's selfish because he had, thank you. He's selfish because he didn't have any money. Yaakov didn't have money. I've got no incentive to let you in. You're running away. You're giving me this sob story. Oh, I was given all, I deceived my father. My brother's after me. I've got nothing. Please let me in. And Lavan thinks, this really is going to be a massive chesed. I get nothing out of this. Ah, but you're my family, so come on in. So one view is that he's selfish. The other view is that actually he was indignant. He was morally indignant that his nephew had tricked people, deceived Esav, stolen from him, tricked your father. You want me to let you into my house? You're a vagabond. Get out of here. But you're my family, so I'll let you in. That's the other view. But there was a whole, no, yeah.
Very often used as a transient term.
Yeah.
It's a temporary thing. It's not permanent. And so Yaakov had an ultimate mission that he was supposed to be going on to, that Hashem was sending him from the Malachim and everything else that said, and that we know from subsequent parshas. So that this period of time that he was with Lavan was just sort of like a bridge between going from to where he's supposed to be.
Okay, interesting. So we'll come to that in one moment. Interesting thought. So just to backtrack a moment for a second, the alternative when he first gets to Lavan's house is that Lavan actually, when he's saying, ach, atzmi v'sariyata, however you are family, was not a concession. He wasn't saying, I shouldn't let you in, but your family. Ach can be read actually as, wow, indeed, ach, right? He says, your family, come on in. And the Kli Yaakov says that actually in that moment, Lavan was listening to this story. Hold on a minute, Lavan says. You deceived a blind man, your father. You stole from a brutal adversary, from your brother, who you don't get on so well with. Says, your family, come on, this is my kind of guy. Atzmi avasariyata, come on in. At which point, Yaakov's thinking, oh, I don't, that wasn't really the point of the story. But he gets drawn into this spiral of deception. And maybe when he says Garzi, he said, I wasn't so comfortable with that culture. And it wasn't that Lavan never let him in, but actually Lavan was eager to have this deceiver in chief come on in. And he says, he's going to love this because at the wedding, you know what I'm going to do to this guy? I'm going to set up the wrong daughter. And we said last week that actually Leah wakes up in the morning, as does Yaakov. And Yaakov says, how could you have deceived me? And Leah says, what are you talking about? You deceive people all the time. This is just how we operate around here. So it's not clear. So those are two views on Lavan Garati. I live with him. Either I never felt welcome, so my blessings never came to fruition, or I never wanted to be welcome. So you should understand that I have conviction and that I've lived a life of commitment and devotion to God. Don't think for a moment that I'm part of that deceptive tradition, that you can make deals with me. I have a backbone, I've got conviction. That's an alternative. And the third view that you've mentioned is that actually it's just a way of saying, not I was in, I was out, it's irrelevant. That's not part of my life. I'm not really giving it much thought. This is where I want to live. And actually next week's parasha, which is called Vayeshev, in the opening pasuk, which we'll put under pressure next week, has the dichotomy between yeshiva and lagur. V'yeshev Yaakov beretz mugurei aviv. He lived in the land, he settled in the land of his father's sojourning. So if we think that gerut is a negative thing here for Yaakov, we're going to have to figure out why his father's with Gerim in that land. We'll get to that next week. Okay, so they go separate ways. He gives Esav gifts, and then he moves along. He goes to a place called Sukkot. Anyone know why it's called Sukkot? Big clue? There was Sukkot there. Right. He actually made the Sukkot. He got there, he set up houses for the people and booths for the animals. And it says, and because he made booths for the animals, he called the place Sukkot, which is in itself a little astonishing. Why is he naming the place after the animals' housing? It's like going camping, building a tent and building a kennel and calling the place kennel, because that's where the animals stayed. Why so much attention being put on the way the animals lived? We don't have to go too far into this. One suggestion is that actually this is an indication. This is the first moment in human history where animals are given attention, where the condition of those who are not human are given care. And that's why he calls it Sukkot. This was a testament. This was the founding moment of Peter. Not the the rock of another faith, but P-E-T-A, that we care about the condition of animals. He then gets to Shechem. Shechem is an incredibly negative episode for two reasons. What are the two things that happen at Shechem? Dina is abducted. You're right, I was being a little PC with my turn of phrase. She's abducted, abused, she's raped, essentially. And the way that that's initiated is also complicated because Dina goes out. She starts to wander. And in some ways, a number of the commentaries almost appear to say she shouldn't have been doing that. Not that she got what she deserved, but there is an uncomfortable initiation to this. V'yetzei Dina, Dina went out to look at the people of the land, and then she gets abducted, abused, humiliated, raped. Horrific treatment, which I may talk about Friday night in Shul. I'll have to think about that. And then Shechem says, you know what, I quite like her, maybe we can get married. She presumably was not consulted on this matter. Although I think, if I'm not incorrect, the novel The Red Tent, anyone read The Red Tent? Yeah. I'm pretty sure this is from the perspective of Dina, am I right? Yeah. I think they made it into a television, because I definitely didn't read it, but I'm pretty sure I saw it. Is the television version?
No, I didn't see it. Perspective and the women, like all the women in the tent.
Right. And it's called The Red Tent for feminine reasons. And there's a very interesting backstory. I mean, one could call it a modern midrash without stretching the term too far. It's essentially filling in what we would call reverently the gaps in the biblical text, the intentional gaps that leave room for our imagination to think about how these scenes could call us morally to behave. And The Red Tent, is that Diamond? Anita Diamond, she wrote the story of Dina's life, because we don't get her words, we don't get her life, we get a moment where she's abducted. Where does she end up? Nobody knows. So she claims that she ended up down in Egypt. And there's a whole backstory. And one of the critiques leveled at Anita Diamond is that she kind of portrays life in the tent as revolving around little idols, that there were these small token gods that they would look at, pray to. They couldn't quite let go of that cultish life that they were brought up with in Lavan's house and other places. Having seen that critique, it's worth pointing out that right after this meeting, right after Shechem, Yaakov tells his family to get rid of all the little idols that they're carrying around with them, and he buries them under a tree. It seems to be that there is some incapacity to let go of this cultish attitude, which in the ancient world was pervasive and compelling in a way that today is not, because even monotheism is difficult for people to get on board with out in the world. So little idols is not that compelling. Now, so that's Sukkot. He gets to Shechem. Dina gets abducted, abused. Shechem comes to Yaakov and says, let's set a marriage. I want to do this. The way that actually, at least the television version imagines it, is that Dina quite enjoyed this. And actually, it wasn't quite as forceful as the text imagines. And she wanted to make this deal, if I remember correctly. That's not the obvious reading of the text. It says she was forced in the text. And Yaakov's sons hear about this event. And they say, okay, we can agree to this match on one condition. Circumcision, all the males. Anyone seen a Robin Hood Men in Tights? Yeah, nobody's keen, especially while in the forest fighting for good. No one's keen to do a Brit Milah in the middle of their life, but they seem to be so convinced that this is a good match, they sign on. 3 days later, Shimon and Levi go on a rampage, murder the men, loot the city, and come home saying, look, Dad, look what we did. And Dad says, what on earth did you do? My reputation. People are going to come after us. You can't just make a deal with people and then back out, slaughter them and take their stuff. And I'm not going to wade into contemporary politics. But the idea that our word is something that needs to be backed up, otherwise we become odious in culture, is quite important. And that also when you go to war, that maybe looting people is somewhat beneath the idea that we shouldn't see our fight as just a way to get more material wealth, but as a way to stand up for values, as a way to stand up for our vision or culture, civilization. Yeah.
A lot of critiques point out that he didn't condemn the act itself.
Meaning, what did he critique?
How it reflects on the family.
Right. It is interesting the way he terms it. He's not saying that what you did was horrific per se, but the results of what you did were horrific. One could say that those really blend into one and the same. He's saying, yeah, maybe they deserved this, but what alternative was there to do this in a way that wouldn't have ruined his reputation? There's no way to do it. So it's one and the same. Saying, yes, I'm not saying they didn't deserve this treatment. Of course, what they did to your sister is horrific. It's my daughter. But at the end of the day, I'm thinking long term. I'm thinking strategy. I'm thinking of survival. You're right. He's not saying what you did was bad. He's saying that you were naive to think that you could get away with that. In fact, how do we know that Bar Mitzvah is at age 13? For many people, it is this moment. Say again. Shimon and Levi here were 13. It says that Ish Charbo, each man took a sword. And if you do the background calculation, it turns out that one of them was 13 at the very least, which says that that's when you become a man, which is an odd way to see human maturity. It's a signal of aggression, of violence, where they are critiqued. And actually, it puts a dampener on when, you know, you remember 13-year-olds get up to Lane and then everyone says, oh, you're a man now. And they're sitting there in, you know, suits that are too big, not really know what they're doing with themselves. No one's suggesting that everything's solved, that you're mature, you're at the end of the road. But this is where maturity begins. And here they're given critique for the way they behave. They're not like, oh, you're a man now, you get to make decisions. They get told off. They don't get blessings at the end of their lives to the same quality as their brothers. So that's Shechem.
There's also a difference when you look at it from Yaakov's perspective. Like, he's the one who actually deserves an incredible amount of critique. Like, where is the father in this game, right? Like, he could clearly had to have known, or if he didn't know, it was a willful sort of ignorance that he should have known. But I think that just sort of brings to the fore a lot of the familial tension of just, okay, coming home to your daughter, you knew what your sons, or you should have known what your sons were doing. You were so worried about your reputation. Where were you in terms of negotiating that? So the parental, like, story of Bereshit of all the dysfunctional families, it just comes out, I think, in a very powerful way.
Yeah, that's very interesting that while Yaakov is critiquing his sons, at least the way the text portrays this scene, he seems quite passive. He doesn't seem to say, okay, we'll make a match, and then turn to his family and say, we need to have a family meeting, and I need to describe what's going through my head. This is horrific. We need to plan long term. We need to figure out a way to get vengeance or protect ourselves, but this is necessary strategically. He doesn't say that. He seems to be absent. And in fact, there's another scene where there is a father who seems to be very reluctant to engage morally with abuse of one of his daughters. I'm thinking of King David. Anyone know that scene? That he has a number of wives with a number of different children. And Tamar, one of his children, is raped by another son of his. And Tamar's brother is incensed by this and kills the perpetrator, at which point David says, you shouldn't have done that, why are you doing that? And Avshalom, who is the son who killed the brother, says, well, how could you not? He raped your daughter, my sister. What happens to Avshalom? He ends up rebelling against his father, trying to overthrow his government, and ends up with long hair hanging from a tree, which is just generally good advice if you're going to war riding horses near forests, get a haircut. But it doesn't end well. And his name, ironically, Avshalom, my father, is peace. Maybe it's a critique. My father was content. My father was passive. My father was silent. Obviously, he falls down as the villain in that scene. But yeah, there are moments where fathers seem to be reluctant to engage in moral indignation over the treatment of their daughters. And this is maybe one of the scenes. Say again?
Well, he was willing to give his daughters to the crowd outside the door.
Well, I think this speaks more broadly to the treatment of women in the ancient world, as opposed to just fathers. But you're right. Women tend to appear in the biblical narrative, usually in the familial context, usually under the auspices of a father or a husband. But yeah, they do seem to get the rough end of treatment in a number of these stories. And of course, you've got the story of Lot, where he offers his daughters to the guests who are trying to abuse his guests. We have the same story in Shoftim. I should say a mirroring story in Shoftim. The Pilegesh Begivah, when somebody as a guest in someone's house comes with his concubine and people... Well, that's at the end. That's not the first thing. You know, warms her up first. Right. And offers out his concubine for abuse instead of himself, meaning he's a guest, and he says, don't abuse me, and the host says, take his concubine. He doesn't seem to complain. And then in the morning, he opens the door, and his concubine's lying on the floor, breathless, without a pulse, and he says, let's go. You know, we got things to do. And she's passed away, at which point he is incensed. And as you say, he cuts her into 12 pieces and sends her body all over the kingdom as a sign of what's happened. Which itself is a signal of debasement. Correct. We'll get to the treatment of women generally, you know, within the decade. So Devorah then dies. Who's Devorah? Right. She is the nurse who accompanied Rivka. She's buried. There's a lot to talk about in that scene as well. It seems that Rivka may have passed away at that moment too, but it goes without mention. We're never told when Rivka dies. She kind of falls out the narrative, and the rabbis, the traditional assumption is this is where she passed away and is buried as well, which is why it was called Alon Bechut, the place of tears. So there was more than one death at that moment. Rachel dies in childbirth, Benjamin is born, Reuven moves his father's bed, which could be euphemistic, could be literal, but problematic either way. Yitzchak passes away at the age of 180. Two people come together to bury their father again. We had Isaac and Ishmael come together to bury Avraham, and now we have Esav and Yaakov come back together to bury their father. Does it end the same way, those two scenes? Yitzchak and Ishmael seem to end on good terms. There is an assumption that they have come close again, they've healed their wounds. Esav and Yaakov come to bury their father, and what happens? So rabbinic tradition is Esav was decapitated, his head fell off and rolled into into Maariat HaMachpelah. His head was buried in there, which we'll come to a little bit later. And then we're given a list of Esav's descendants, the kings of Seir, an indication that far before the Davidic dynasty arose, there were kings in the ancient world that came from Esav, which shows that actually the focus of Jewish life is less about power than it is about family. While Esav is building kingdoms and nations, we're building family stories. And actually, Rav Hirsch suggests that this entire parasha is about the clash between politics and family, that Yaakov comes on the one hand laden with wives and children and possessions and donkeys and camels, kind of a moving family. And Esav is approaching with 400 men marching with no idea where their families are. It's not described. And this is basically the clash of civilizations, one that is focused on power and one that is focused on the family and the home. And it's about what happens when those two things come into conflict. That's where Rav Hirsch reads this parasha. Now, page one, our only page, we're going to look back at that scene. And this is quite timely when we speak about anti-Semitism. I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, are familiar with what happened a couple of days ago in Jersey City that now appears to be an act of intentional anti-Semitic violence. And while we're talking about the elections in Britain today, there's a lot of concern and anxiety about the fate of the country, the culture, relating to anti-Semitism in particular, and of course the executive order that was signed, I think it was yesterday, defining Judaism as a nation, and how that feeds into the discussion, one way or other. Anyone familiar with that, that happened? So yesterday, the president signed an executive order defining Judaism as a nation. Now, there is a very technical reason why that was signed. It wasn't just, oh, why not? And the Hanukkah dinner was yesterday in the White House. It wasn't just like, oh, why not? The Jews are coming. Let's sign a declaration. The very specific technical reason is because it's to do with funding university campuses. University campuses get additional government funding, but the government can refuse funding if they fail to stop discrimination of certain sorts, which include discrimination against national origin, but not about religion. So by defining Judaism as a national entity, they can withhold funding from campuses that don't combat anti-Semitism, which includes, according to the definition in the executive order, BDS. So essentially it's a way to withhold funding from universities that don't combat BDS. That's the technical reason. But it got into all sorts of cultural back and forths about defining Jews as a nation, feeding into the idea that we are disloyal, that we have our own national allegiance, all sorts of things. And of course, this particular president seems to rouse division among people at all costs, at all the time, that he has ardent defenders and ardent critics, and anything he does is generally spit along party lines. So it's hard to speak about the issue without getting caught into a brawl or a fight, but it's worth discussing either way. What does this mean? And I pointed out, I think it was last week, maybe not in Arsha, but somewhere else, that this happened in Britain in the 1970s. Jews appealed to be defined as a racial identity, so that we could not, so we could hold people account for discriminating against Jews on a racial basis, which about 10 years ago came back to haunt the community because they had to, they were sued in court for not letting someone into a Jewish school because they weren't Jewish. And they were, hold on, if you say being Jewish is a race, this is racial discrimination. And they had to change the acceptance rules to getting into Jewish schools. Now, the chief rabbi's got no authority to say you're Jewish, you're halachically Jewish, you're not, because that's racial discrimination by the standards that Jews themselves sought 40 years ago. So now to get into Jewish schools in London and England, you have to be a practicing observant Jew, which by the definitions of the government mean you go to synagogue, you have a relationship with a rabbi. So you could have somebody who was born Catholic, never converted, and just goes to synagogue three times a year, puts a little thing in the box that says they've been there, and then they can get into a Jewish school. It also happened to help the Jewish community a little bit because most Jews in England are Orthodox affiliated but not observant, and this forced them to go to shul a couple times a year. So in that way, it made people re-engage a little bit. Either way, talking of anti-Semitism in the 4 minutes that we have left. V'yisa Yaakov Einav. Yaakov lifts up his eyes. And this is a familiar turn of phrase because actually each of the patriarchs have a moment when they lift up their eyes and they see something. V'yisa Yaakov Einav Vayar. Jacob lifted up his eyes and he saw. If you can complete the sentence, V'yisa Avraham Einav Vayar Shlosha Anashim. This is right at the beginning of Parsha Vayera. Avram lifts up his eyes and he sees. What does he see? What we presume are three angels. Two parshas later, Yitzchak lifts up his eyes. Yisa Yitzchak Einav Vayar V'hine Gemalim Ba'im. There are camels coming, carrying his future wife. And here we have Yisa Yaakov Einav Vayar. Yaakov lifts up his eyes and he sees V'hine Esav Ba. And Esav is coming. And if you draw a trajectory through the patriarchs. The first lifts his eyes and sees angels. The second lifts his eyes and sees camels. And the third lifts his eyes and sees Esav. How would you draw that? A deterioration, perhaps, in vision. It's interesting. One could say that it doesn't have to be quantified in the positive or negative, but really they see different challenges, and it's how they react that is key. I mentioned that with Yitzchak. But there does seem to be a deterioration, at least in the celestial quality of their vision. One seeing angels, one seeing camels, and one is seeing an enemy. V'imo arba, and it could be that it's not about their character. It's about life gets more challenging. And as the patriarchs build up the cultural memory of what it means to be Jewish, we have to understand that things get tough, things get harder as we grow, as we mature, as we develop nationally, personally. Familiarly, more challenges come. You think, you know, under the chuppah, you're seeing angels. And as family life gets more complicated, you have to deal with the camels in life, and then hostility, adversaries, there are all sorts of things, generally. Okay. That is not a comment on my married life, for anyone listening to the recording. Just a general observation about human life. Sorry, Miriam. Forgive me for that. V'hinei Esav ba Esav comes. V'imo arba meot ish. And there were 400 men with him. V'yachat said hiyaladim. He split up the children. That is not Solomon's solution. He didn't cut them in half. He split them into two groups. Although I'm sure there are midrashim that suggest there are all sorts of interesting readings. Al Leah v'al Rachel, between Leah and Rachel, v'ashvchot, and between the two maidens. V'yaratz Esav likrato, and Esav runs to greet him. And again, if you're putting this on the screen, you'd have him running, weapons on his side, and you'd see him rushing, and Yaakov going, "Oh my God, he's going to kill me!" And he gives him a big hug, big embrace. And he says, "Whoa, this is..." And you can imagine Yaakov standing there taken aback, not really returning. This wasn't a mutual hug. This is him really taken aback. And he fell on his shoulder and he kissed him. Who fell on whose shoulder and who kissed who? Good question, right? It's not clear from the text. It says, he ran towards him. Who hugged who, by the way? We're presuming Esav, but we could read this radically differently. How could we read this scene? Go on. Esav, v'yaratz Esav likrato. Esav came running to greet him. Maybe he did have his sword in his hand. Maybe he was going to kill him, strike him down. V'chabikehu, and what happened? Yaakov hugged him. Maybe that's what broke the moment. Maybe we don't have to view Yaakov as this passive figure who's taken aback by his brother's sudden embrace, but as a figure who combats violence with a hug. I'm not suggesting in a fight that you should embrace your enemy, but maybe on some symbolic quality, Yaakov was being suggested here that diplomacy wins. Yaakov's not a feeble victim here. He's carrying a family and he's showing them, he's modeling for them, how do you combat violence? In fact, talking of Rabbi Sacks, they have a pull-out quote on the back of a number of his books. And I think on the back of To Heal a Fractured World, at least the British version, they have American and British versions. I don't know why, they got different publicists. On British books, it's got his name on the front as Jonathan Sacks. In America, they put Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Apparently things sell better here if they think you're a faith leader, and they sell worse in England if they think you're a faith leader. This is an interesting observation. So either way, on the back of the English version of To Heal a Fractured World, it says the only way to combat a relentless hate is with a relentless love or something, which sounds quite hippie-ish to some degree, but at least on a symbolic level, not naive, but symbolically, the only way to combat an ideology of hate is to promote an ideology of love, is not just multiply hate. And here maybe Yaakov stands up and he embraces his brother and says, "Stop this! Enough war! Enough fighting! I've got a family. Let me introduce you." Maybe this is how Thanksgiving begins for many of you. Family come round, they're armed with political facts to take down the rest of the group. And then you say, "Just give me a hug. Forget this. I don't want to talk about Trump forever. Let me just give you a hug and be done with it." Maybe that's what happens. And maybe Esav is the one who then falls on his shoulder. And maybe Yaakov kisses him. Maybe Yaakov puts his head in Esav. The whole thing is described in such sublime ambiguity that we can play out this scene in all sorts of ways. But they both cried. That is the only clear verb here. They both cried. There is a shedding of tears. Now, why are they crying? Maybe relief. the key word there being maybe, in the same way that this is an ambiguous moment. People cry joy, people cry relief, people cry in pain, people cry suffering, people cry and they don't know why they're crying. But maybe relief, what's the relief? That this was a tense moment that had been building at least overnight, if not for longer, in Yaakov's mind. We don't know about long how long this has been playing out in Esau's mind. He doesn't seem to bring up the birthright again. He doesn't seem to play out that scene. He seems to have forgotten. But maybe it's a release of tension. There are different ways to read this. There is one strange pointing here, literally. There are points. There are dots on top of the word v'yishakehu, and he kissed him. Now, what do the dots mean? Something. Excellent. That itself is debated. In the next box, Ibn Ezra says, they don't mean nothing. Not quite in those words, but he says, Hadarash al hanakudot v'yishakehu tovu la'atike misadayim. Meaning, the people who start giving drushas about the dots says, that's nice for kids. That's what he says. Now, the Ibn Ezra also happened to have been, at some level, involved with mystical study, and it's quite possible he thought that this had mystical valence, but really, we don't know what to do with it. It seems odd for him to say it's meaningless, right? Because it is there and it's unusual. But that's his view. That don't start talking to me. What do people traditionally say the dots represent? Anyone familiar? Teeth, right? The little tooth marks. Anyone ever seen a kid bite somebody and then had to tell them off? They leave little tooth marks in your skin when they bite you. Maybe that's when he says, oh, that's good for kids. But that's not really what's going on. Rabbeinu Barakhia says, Yadua ki kol teva shunukidah b'cholak tuvim ha'inyan li'tarot davar. This obviously is to teach something. Why would you have dots if it wasn't to communicate a particular message? That's Rabbeinu Barakhia. So what is it to teach then? If it has to communicate something, we want to know what that is. What do the dots do? Rashi says it is to pierce what seems to be the clear meaning. Why would you kiss somebody? Usually kisses are affectionate or not affectionate. Usually they're affectionate. So for Rashi, it's piercing that meaning. Him, yeshidarshu nekudazu, lo mashalo nashku b'kol libo. This is to insinuate they didn't really mean to kiss him. It was one of those formal things, or maybe it was insincere. This was a ploy, this was an act. Esav kissed him, and these dots tell you, red alert, beep, beep, beep. This was not real affection. This is not on the screen, this is in a text, and it's ambiguous, so we need to give you some insinuation. This was not an affectionate kiss. So why is he kissing him? Maybe they were French and they just kiss everybody. Or maybe, what else is the Midrash? That maybe he was feeling around for jewels on his cheek. It's not the best way to do it, to kiss somebody's cheek. Oh, is he hiding any jewels in there? That was the assumption of Lavan as well back then. Everybody's trying to find jewels in people's mouth. I don't know why they don't check their pockets. But either way, that's one view. Say again? Oh, you're right, they didn't have pockets. They should. Maybe that's the embrace. Feeling everyone says, I don't have anything, get off. Maybe that's one way to view that. The Sifrei, however, quotes what is a more famous statement. Rav Shimon bar Yochai Omer, he said, Halacha, it is a fact, halacha, which just means it's a norm. We know this. B'yadua she'esav sona le'yakov. We know Esav hates Yaakov. And this is cited all the time in the context of anti-Jewish hatred. Yadua, it's well known, Esav sona le'yakov, that we have enemies. There are people who hate us. Here it's given an identity, a face. Esav hates Yaakov. And Rabbi Sachs, in the next statement that I've got there, which beneath has the picture of Esav and Yaakov hugging, which was the moment caught on camera. So you should know that's actually what happened. So Rabbi Sachs says, this is always quoted to show that anti-Semitism is inevitable, that it is insurmountable, and it is perpetual through history. You can't escape anti-Semitism. Halacha b'yadua. Esav sonet Yaakov. It's well known that Esav hates Yaakov. And Rabbi Sachs said, well, what's the end of the statement? Ella nevchu rachamav ba'uto sha'av v'nashku b'chol libo. And those dots tell us, not they don't pierce the meaning of the phrase, they pierce our expectations. Our expectations are, reading that sentence, oh, he didn't really mean it. We know Esav hates Yaakov. He's kissing him, he's trying to find out where the jewels are. This is an act. This is a front. That's our expectation, reading this scene naturally. And Shimon bar Yochai says, those dots tell you to pierce your expectations, to read it literally, not to go against the grain, but to actually allow the grain to flow here. That when he kisses him, despite the fact that Esav hates Yaakov, and we know that in this moment, this was a sincere embrace and affection. So Rabbi Sacks suggests that actually the whole citation used to suggest that anti-Semitism is inevitable is in fact a declaration that it is not inevitable, that there are moments that we are capable of transcending that and having sincere affection. And this is part of his book, Not in God's Name, suggesting, and elsewhere, suggesting that actually if we make an effort to overcome anti-Semitism, if we advocate for bilateral relations, if we reach out and make friends, we don't have to hunker down behind walls and say they're all coming for us anyway. History always repeats itself. We can try our best to forestall anti-Semitism. In fact, I think I saw on YouTube, there's some fellow making a series called It's Hard to Hate People You Know, or something like that. Is that what it's called? Did anybody else see that? And they're trying their best to take people from different cultures, different backgrounds, and just spending time with each other. And actually, when you get to meet people, it's very hard to hate them. Anyone heard of Darren Brown? Darren Brown, he's British. I won't blame him if you haven't. Anyone here got Netflix? More people than I think just said yes, probably. He's got a number of series on Netflix, and if you're sitting there tonight thinking, oh, I've got a few moments, I want to watch something interesting, have a look at Darren Brown. He's a not a psychologist, not a mind reader, I think he called himself an illusionist. But he says, I don't have powers, this is not mysticism, this is just long, hard training as to how the human mind works, how to read body language, etc. And he does a number of shows and has a number of programs to show how we behave under pressure and elsewhere. One of them is called The Push. I think that's still on Netflix, where he manages through psychological manipulation, through actors and setting up the scene, to essentially lead somebody to push somebody else off a roof, them thinking that they are killing this person in order to get out of a tight spot. And he interviews these people in advance, and they send in applications, and they're all told they're rejected, and then he somehow gets them to come in and sorts it all out. They sign waivers in advance, but they don't think it's the part of the program. And they say, I would never kill anybody, no matter what pressure. And then he puts them in a situation, and they have to confront the fact that they were willing to kill someone. There's another one where he takes somebody who's on the hard right, anti-immigrant, and he leads him to a situation where he ends up taking a bullet for an illegal immigrant. It's not a real bullet, and he's laced his jacket with ketchup or special effects, and he doesn't realize that, but he thinks he's shot, and he sees himself bleeding, and he can't believe that he dived in to save this guy. And one of the ways that he does it is there's a psychological fact that if you sit down and you stare into somebody's eyes for 3 minutes, statistically, it's been established that you make a bond that it's hard to break. And they sit there looking into each other's eyes for 3 minutes to try and build this relationship. And he ends up saying, please, can I just hug you? Please, I want to hug you. I can't just sit here. And they end up crying and hugging. It's a very strange thing, but that's also worth watching. It's on Netflix. Either way, bottom of the page, the Radak says the teeth issue. And I just want to give some airing to this. I'm Rabbi Yonah. Rabbi Yonah says, bottom of the page, Lama nakad alav? Why are there dots on top of these words? Melamed shelo bikesh lenashko ela lenashko. To tell us that Esav didn't want to kiss him. And this is a misleading description. It wasn't a kiss. What did he try to do? Lenashko, he wanted to bite his neck. But what happened? Naased savaro shel Yaakov shel sheish v'sheinav shel Esav shel sha'avah. What happened? Yaakov's neck turned to marble, Esav's teeth turned to wax. You try and bite with wax teeth on marble, not good solution. Which also answers another question, why is he crying? He just broke his teeth. That's why he's crying, which is a way to understand this text. So it solves the dots and it solves the crying. Now, why do I mention this? Because on the literal reading of this, it's suggesting again that this was not an affectionate moment. But actually, if one puts a little bit of pressure, not just on the Pasuk, but also on the Perush, on the Midrash, maybe this is symbolic. That in the last 20 years, we would imagine that he would want to come and bite him. But what happened over the last 20 years? Yaakov, the little innocent tent dweller, who was the little guy who went around thieving and deceiving, has actually grown a backbone, has become independent, has become strong, has become a figure of agency and power. His neck has become marble. And what happened to the aggressive, vicious hunter? His teeth have turned to wax. He has softened and his brother has hardened. And actually, this is not just a description of a legendary, fantastical meeting where necks turn to stone and teeth melt. But this is a description of their characters over the last 20 years. That in this moment of meeting, when we would have expected an act, a clash and a violent meeting, we actually have two figures who've changed radically in the last 20 years. One has softened and one has hardened, and the expectations are overturned. And actually, this is a real, sincere affection, not a broken one, which calls us to think about when we see people, that things may have transpired in between. People shift, people change over time, and expectations can be overturned, and wounds can be healed. We'll stop there. And I wish you all a good Shabbat.